This is Scott Becker with a special podcast from Becker's Healthcare. We have on with us today a brilliant emergency room physician who's also been involved in hospital leadership, served as chairman of the board of a hospital, has founded several things, has done a lot, really bright guy, Dr. Paul Summerside. We're going to talk to Paul about the coronavirus, where he sees this going, just some of his thoughts. Paul, can you take a moment and introduce yourself, and then we'll go from there.
Yeah, hi, I'm Paul Summerside. I've had a pretty long career that's probably focused primarily on hospital healthcare operations and quality and efficiency, broadly speaking, and have an emergency medicine background. So do some consulting work, but otherwise I'm living a great life.
Thank you very much. And I know you've got a wife, five kids spread throughout the country, all in sort of different perspectives right now. One working in a health system, one working in one of the most coronavirus-impacted areas. You know, any thoughts as you start to pull your thoughts together on this, and I know you to be a brilliant person, and I know we're all dealing with information overload, but any thoughts on how this sort of plays through? Then I'll ask your advice for providers. What would you do if you were czar of the government now? You know, any thoughts on how this all plays through ultimately?
Well, on a macro level, I think that, you know, you can look at this as a stress testing, right? You could look at the 2008 disaster financially as stress testing on some very corrupt financial systems. And I think you could look at this as stress testing on what is really an incredibly, I won't say corrupt, that's not the right word for the healthcare system, but is an extremely inefficient, poorly integrated, expensive relic. And it's a stress test of the system, and the system is completely unable to respond, you know. And that's what we're seeing, and I hope that it is prompting a better discussion, rather than an us against them, a discussion, a better discussion about how to make this a more efficient, integrated, and effective healthcare system.
And thank you. Isn't it fascinating? You look at it in terms of a stress testing on our healthcare system, on our government, on our financial structure, a stress test on all these things, and you just hope ultimately that the fact that we've got the largest, most robust economy in the world by a degree of four times or so is enough to help us in the long term pull us through this. Aside from and together with, and more importantly, limiting loss of life too. You just hope that it's an imperfect system, but I guess that's the most positive prognosis, is we're the largest country in the world economically, and that ultimately we'll be able to rebound from this.
Yeah, you know, the good news is that we've got a lot of resources, and then if used appropriately, we certainly have the resources to respond to this. But, you know, we also have the resources to waste. And so if they're not used appropriately, it doesn't matter how much money, resources, you know, if people are lighting their cigars with $100 bills, you can burn up your resources pretty fast. So right now, I think we're burning up our resources pretty fast. Our resources have been going to things that don't benefit the country at large, and have left, I think this is exposing, as you said, a number of things. It's exposing the fragility of a large segment of our economy that has absolutely no resources, even to go through a week without a paycheck. You know, so it's the healthcare fragility that this is exposing. It's the hourly wage earners' fragility. It's the healthcare benefits issue of the common man, the revenue structure of the healthcare system. You know, how are hospitals going to get paid for what's going on? No one's even talked about that, right? So, yeah, we have a lot of resources, but if they're not employed correctly, it will do no good, right?
Well, it isn't this the scary thing of the government throwing a trillion here or a trillion there? And at some point, there's not enough trillions left to throw to solve things if they're thrown without discipline and unintelligently. I mean, isn't that exactly true, that if you're throwing resources at stuff, and it's not been some deep thought about or some thought about where are they going and how are they going there, that we end up with so much debt that it takes forever to get the economy back on a stable footing.
Right. If the resources, if the resources are misapplied, they will actually make the core problems worse, right? The resources misapplied could actually make the problems in the healthcare system worse. The resources misapplied could actually make the economic disparities worse, right? They could saddle the poorest full-time workers in the country with more debt and still leave them with no safety net, and we could end up worse off than we were. But if appropriately applied and saying, hey, like we said, this is a stress test, we've identified the weaknesses, let's shore up the weaknesses, then I think there's a lot of hope. You know, we've got a burning platform to make some decisions that in a status quo environment are politically impossible, even though, you know, behind closed doors, discerning minds will agree they need to be made. Now maybe we've got the burning platform to make some of those difficult political decisions possible. I'm not sure, you know, not this isn't a political statement at all, but I mean, all you have to do is pull up a YouTube, one of Governor Cuomo's press conferences, and then pull up one of Trump's best press conferences, and you can say, okay, what do you think the hope of federal leadership through this is? And not to borrow in your legal terms, but it's a loquitur.
Yeah. Meaning, it seems clear to you that the complexity of it is the beauty of watching Governor Cuomo talk, at least by and large, he's not politicizing his talk. And he's talking about what we think of or thought of as good government, compassionate government. But what's been so lost, I think, on the right and left is this focus on what actually is good, efficient government. It seems like on the right side, and I'll go back to you, Etienne, for a second, it's just sort of protective of the current system without thinking about how do we have the best intelligence in the world? How do we have the best health system in the world? How do we try and be great? There's not this focus on what I think of as good government, and part of that's by design because the Republican Party has posed themselves as the party of less government, but that's not really the reality today. On the left side, and this seems like the only reason why the left continues to lose some elections, maybe they should win, is they can't focus on good government. They just seem to focus so much on hating the right and on some other themes as opposed to focusing just on good government. And it's one of the reasons you talk about Governor Cuomo, why he's such a pleasure to listen to. He's not doing what the Illinois governor is doing, which is using half his airtime to blast Trump, nor what some other politicians are doing, but he's using 93% of his airtime, and instead I've just made up, to focus on what has to be done and what is good government and caring about people. And it seems like on the right and left, a little bit more of that in a genuine way that's not just bashing the other side would go a long way towards moving us closer to what we really all want.
Yeah, absolutely. I think if you listen to Cuomo's press conference, you wouldn't have any, if you didn't know anything else, if you just were dropped here from somewhere, you wouldn't know what party he belonged to. You know, and he's very careful, which I think is a really interesting thing about his press conference. He's very careful to separate fact from opinion. You know, he'll warn people, okay, now this is my opinion, you know, and then he'll say something, and then he'll say, okay, now this is a fact, this is data, you know, and you have a right to an opinion, but you don't have a right to your own facts. And I think that is such a refreshing way to talk about issues, right? And it's a problem-solving way to talk about issues. Here are the facts, and we can both have opinions on how to apply solutions to these facts, but we don't have a choice to ignore the truth when it is visible.
you know, to take you to another question, and I know I'll get in trouble with this with part of our audience, but when I look at a President Sanders, a President Biden, or President Trump, when you say that this kind of crisis exposes things and fragility and issues, I mean, and I'm not going to bash any one of those three, but in a real crisis, as you see a real crisis, and we've not seen a real crisis in the country in some time, none of those, at least to me, really imposes confidence that they would be up to the challenge. I mean, I know myself, but I'm a certain age range. It was probably sharper 10 years ago. These guys are 40 years older than me, or 35 or so. No, not that much, I guess, anymore. But the concept being, none of them inspires great confidence. And I'm not sure, what's wrong with our system that's where we're at?
I think the best answer to that is the demands of the presidency are greater than any one man. I don't care who they are. And so I think that when you look at qualifications for a president, I'll do my Cuomo on you. This is obviously totally opinion, that a very high ego state is almost disqualifying for a good president, because the issues facing any president, much less a president in crisis situations, are too complex for one person to be up on all of them. And so you can't have this ego that you have to be right and you have to be the source of all truth. You have to be able to assemble a team of people that you can rely on completely. You have to have a low enough threshold of ego that you actually turn whole decisions over to another team and you sign off on their work 100%. That's what good executives do. And you live and die by the team you put together, not by your own intellect. Because it's a bigger job than any one person can handle. So when you put those three guys together, you know, the question, you know, that I would ask is, which one of those candidates is most likely to put together a really strong team and rely on them to work together?
Right. So you've seen The Apprentice. And so, obviously, Dr. Summerside, you would think that President Trump would be the best at that because he's constantly picking out talent.
He's literally pushing worldwide exports out of the way of the microphone so that he can say something that is 100% completely wrong. You know, he's the actually opposite of a good executive. You know, in any company other than a wholly owned sole proprietorship, which, you know, last time I looked, we aren't that as a country.
Well, and that is one of the great problems, whether you like him or don't like him, and whether he ends up being directionally right on a couple of big decisions that might end up having a great impact for us in a positive way, and it remains to be seen. It sure does seem like at times he's running it like a sole proprietorship, and we are a nation of 350 million people. And you know, and he might end up being very directly right on a couple big decisions that save us a lot of deaths. But it sure is not explained in a way that seems to make sense or in a way that's thoughtful and that resonates with a lot of people. But he's getting good approval ratings for his handling of this, at least in the most recent polls from very reputable sources. So sort of a fascinating thing. Anyways, taking you back, Paul, how does this end? How do we get through this crisis clinically? How do we get from point A to point B?
I guess there's two things. You know, there's things you can control and things you can't control, right? On the macro area, well, say I'm a hospital executive at that level, what can you control? And then, well, you can't control what the government does over how you get paid, right, through this. You're taking care of all kinds of people right now. Depending on the city you're in, you could be overwhelmed with people, really sick people with conditions that typically have very poor compensation. At the same time, you've got staggering employment costs relative to keeping your hospital staffed in a really inefficient way because of all the infection precautions. You know, the work gets very inefficient when people have to go through all those precautions. So you've got the macro issue of how are you going to get paid for this work you're doing, plus you've got the macro issue of the kind of soft dictate that you have to not do any of the work that you actually get paid for, which would be elective surgery, for instance. So that's a macro issue, but I don't really know how an individual CEO can respond to that. I think as an individual CEO, again, if you take the, this is a stress testing of your efficiency. If you had any doubt before, this should expose the fact that La La Land is over. You know, the American healthcare system and how hospitals operate has to focus on incredibly efficient, science-based operations. That this manner in which we run hospitals hasn't really changed a lot. You know how we ran our hospital was materially different than the status quo, and we had materially different financial results. And yet we still were prohibited from taking what would be called truly efficient, objective-based actions on operation performance. You know, I'll go off on one of my great topics, the electronic medical record adoption. You know, the fact that an industry could adopt something that fundamentally made it so inefficient, lost it so much money, and the only really objective criteria that you can say it succeeded in is it created digital records for billing. Other than that, it's pretty much failed in its clinical application. In spite of the fact that as a country, we spent, I don't know, it could be trillions by now, you know? I mean, there are individual cell systems that have spent billions. So, and it made providers less efficient. It didn't deliver its promise of quality, on and on. And it made us actually more digitally unsafe, right? So our records are actually safer from hacking when they were paper than they are now. So we don't have a more secure environment. The records themselves are scientifically worthless, you know, and they cost us untold amounts of money. And we could do that experiment. No other industry would have even embarked on that experiment, right? If you had to take a 3-week course to learn how to use your iPhone, how many iPhones would they sell? The answer is zero. Well, they've got to give a 6-week course to bring a new person into an office to run their electronic medical record. How stupid is that? You know, one of the big things that we've got right now, labor problems we have, is there's tons of retired nurses, doctors, whatever, or laid off people, or people that came out of the workforce for a period of time to have kids or anything. You know, in past medical shortages, the hospital could rehire them. They could walk right in and start working pretty much because they can still write and
right.
They can still read. Now they can't. Like my wife, the nurse, thought about coming back into health, and she can't even operate the electronic medical record, so she can't work.
And so let me do this, and that is the added complexity, and so many parts of our life is a true sort of double-edged sword. I mean, you look at your car, it used to be easy to repair, relatively expensive. Now it's driven by those electronic systems, and the guy has to have a master's to fix it and charges you like he has a master's. So as long as we're on a tangent, Paul, and then I want to take you back to subject. I mean, you're a Green Bay Packer fan. You're from Wisconsin. As the Packers have fallen in greatness the last several years, I know we're off topic for a second. How hard has that been for you emotionally?
Well, I wasn't born here, so it's not. For a few of my kids, it's emotionally draining. For me, it's interesting. But I think that it's been a fantastic. See, I moved up here when the Packers were horrible 32 years ago. They were horrible. And so I've watched the rise. And even in their lowest days in the last 3 or 4 years, they're factors of magnitude better than they were 30 years ago. So I think it's kind of humorous. But, yeah, it's interesting, but they're still beating up on the Bears. So that's really all that matters. And they still beat the Vikings in the playoffs. So, you know, the hometown is happy. You know, you beat the Vikings and you beat the Bears in the same season. You know, you can't beat that.
Well, we do view that. You know, we are bringing the Packers into it. To bring the Bears into it, we see as kind of a low blow and a little bit of a cheap shot. So on that, Paul, we'll finish up today. But just a pleasure visiting with you about your thoughts on coronavirus, your thoughts on our political situation, your thoughts on leadership and how important in leadership it is. You know, it's all about building great teams, and I think your point is well taken. But, Paul, just a pleasure visiting with you, as always. We'll hope to have you on again in a week or two. Thank you so much. Dr. Summerside, thank you.
You bet.
Jeremy, thank you.
Thanks, Pat.